May it please the court, my name is Ned Jekyll. I appear on behalf of the petitioner in this case, Jaime Perez. Your Honors, I think it's clear from the briefs of both parties in this case that the search that the officer conducted in this case does not meet either of the two factors that would allow a search incident to arrest that were announced by the United States Supreme Court in Arizona v. Gant. As I said, I think that's clear from the briefs of both parties. In short, Mr. Perez could not access a weapon at the time of the search. He was secured, he was cuffed, he was in the back of the patrol car, thus not meeting the first prong of Arizona v. Gant. Second, the search conducted here was not for evidence of the crime of arrest. Mr. Perez was pulled over for a traffic violation. He was arrested on an outstanding warrant on what appeared to be a traffic-related matter. So it meets neither prong of Gant. I don't believe the Attorney General disputes that. Instead, what the Attorney General defends the search on are two bases, and which I will address in turn. The first basis is the Attorney General suggests that Mr. Perez does not have standing to complain about the search that was conducted here. The second basis is the Attorney General invites this court to extend the good faith exception to an area where it has never previously been extended by the United States Supreme Court, that is, an officer's belief in what the case law, whether the case law authorizes a search or not. As to the standing issue, I believe that the standing issue, especially in light of Gant, is really just a red herring here. It is a non-issue in this case. Regardless of the status of the glove box in the car, there's no dispute that Mr. Perez had an expectation of privacy in the passenger compartment of the car. That is in the trial court's ruling that he had such an expectation of privacy. It is also conceded by the state in their brief, I think at page 10.
That, Mr. Jacob, that's an interesting way to say that. What are you suggesting then, that he did not have an expectation of privacy with regard to the trunk?
I'm sorry, that he did not have an expectation. I don't think there's any.
You said he had an expectation of privacy with regard to the passenger compartment.
Yes.
I was curious about why you limited it that way rather than saying with regard to the car.
Well, the reason I limited it is part of the next part of my argument, which is I'm only talking about the passenger compartment because that.
You said interior, as I remember.
The evidence.
Interior of the car, you said. He had standing as the lawful driver
right.
of the car
yes.
for the interior, right?
Yes, the interior of the car.
And then the search was first conducted before the words were, I don't know what's inside, it's not my combination, and so forth, right? So that's your argument?
Well, my argument is that the evidence that was seized, that was used against him at trial, was seized as a fruit of the officer's entry into the passenger compartment of the car. And that's why I'm focused on the passenger compartment and didn't express any opinion about the trunk. I guess
all right, maybe I interrupted you too quick,
Cliff. Okay. And so, anyway, it doesn't mean the
point. Can I ask you why that doesn't make a difference? Why does that make a difference? Let's assume you're absolutely correct.
That he has standing.
If he says yes, he says really the search just occurred before he says, you know, I don't know what's in the glove compartment, right?
I think that's my understanding. I think that's the right sequence.
So he peeks in, does the search, and so forth. But why does that make it? Why is that a red herring on the issue of standing?
Well, the trial court's ruling is based on saying, well, Mr. Perez disavowed interest in the glove box. He said that he doesn't have access to the glove box. I mean, and standing, that was the basis of the trial court's ruling.
Well, maybe I'm confused about the facts and you can help me out. Didn't he initially, at the time when the stop occurred, take the position this wasn't his car, it was his friend's car, and then evolved into the glove compartment with the padlock on the glove compartment. He says, I don't have the combination. No one the passenger didn't have the combination.
Yeah, he told the officer that it wasn't his car, that it belonged to a friend of the passenger, but it's uncontroverted that he's driving it with authorization. And therefore, under this court's previous precedent, that he has standing to complain about a search of the car.
Okay, but I thought the argument on the glove box was that he said, it was locked with his padlock, apparently, sort of locked. And I thought he asserted, I don't have that combination, I don't know anything about it, and all that kind of thing.
Yeah, the evidence is somewhat controverted in that point. I believe he did make a statement like that to the officer. The officer also says he made inculpatory statements to him that, the drugs in the glove box are mine. The evidence is controverted at the suppression hearing, I believe.
Well, it sounds like his story evolved over time, probably.
Yeah, I think that's probably correct, Your Honor.
But is it your position that the right of privacy argument, expectation of privacy, can't be just focused on the glove box, that since he had reasonable expectation of privacy in the whole passenger compartment, that included glove boxes?
Precisely. And okay. That's also contained in the supplemental authority I cited. I hope I have this correct. I believe it's a Tenth Circuit case, Ferreira, although it might be the other Tenth Circuit case that I cited in the supplemental authority.
Go ahead.
So, officer, the evidence that's ultimately used against him at trial is seized through exploitation of what we now know under Gantt was an illegal entry in search of the passenger compartment of the car. Turning to the second point raised by the state, invites this court to extend the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule to police officers' reported good faith reliance on case law. And I think there are several reasons why that is wrong, some of which were talked about in the previous argument. First off, I mean, quite obviously, the Supreme Court has never extended the good faith exception in that manner. In fact, the good faith exception really almost exclusively has only applied in the context of a warrant, the police officer's reliance on a warrant, whether that warrant is ultimately proved to be valid or not, but it always is in the context of a warrant. The sole exception, of course, being Krull, but in Krull you have really the functional equivalent of a warrant. It's really, I don't know that it has any applicability to the officer on the street sort of situation, where in that case, the Supreme Court is addressing a state statute and a heavily regulated industry, an administrative type of search, and a routine search conducted pursuant to that state statute. But the Supreme Court has never extended it to the situation where the an officer is relying on his understanding of case law and whether his facts fit the case law and so on and so forth. I don't think you need to look any further than, of course, the Gantt opinion to see that the Supreme Court does not contemplate applying the Supreme Court, the good faith exception in this case. First, quite obviously, the exclusionary rule applies to Mr. Gantt. The Arizona Supreme Court ordered the evidence suppressed. The United States Supreme Court affirmed that decision.
So it really doesn't matter what the dissent says, and that's the problem with Belton, is that Justice Brennan made some observations about Belton that apparently had been used to characterize the decision itself, and the U.S. Supreme Court says that isn't a good method of analysis, is it? The dissent not being the law,
right?
How the dissent characterizes the majority doesn't matter.
No, I don't think it does, although I think there is something very telling in the dissent in Gantt, and that is Justice Alito's statement that he leads off with, where he speaks about good faith reliance, and he is obviously contemplating that the decision in Gantt will result in the suppression of evidence in, for example, Mr. Perez's case. Because Justice Alito says that this decision, and I think I can quote it, court's decision will cause, and note the use of the future tense here, the suppression of evidence in many searches carried out the past tense, in good faith reliance on well-settled case law. I don't think there's any other conclusion that you can draw from that than that the court is contemplating that its decision will result in the suppression of evidence, even if the police officer in good faith is relying on the understanding of Belton at the time of the search. Secondly, I think also incorporated into that understanding, the majority as well, of course, talks about police reliance issues and suggests that that police reliance issues don't trump the Fourth Amendment violation. I think Justice Alito's opinion also sort of leads me to my next point, which is retroactivity, which was discussed somewhat in the previous case. Retroactivity really requires the court to not apply the good faith exception in this case. The previous counsel for the state, I think, discussed Johnson and talked about the new case or the new decision sort of thing. Well, Griffith v. Kentucky resolves that issue. Johnson is not good law on that point. Griffith v. Kentucky indicates that retroactivity applies even in the new case or a new rule, to any new rule for a case, as Mr. Perez's case, that's pending on direct appeal. That doctrine, the retroactivity doctrine, rests squarely on the principle of treating similarly situated defendants alike. And I submit that Mr. Perez is identically situated with Mr. Gant, and therefore the correct remedy is also suppression of the evidence in this case. If there are no further questions, I'll reserve the rest.
Could I hold you for just one quick distinction about something you raised for me in one of your supplemental authorities, but also something you said today? Is your argument about standing dependent in any way on you characterizing the evidence found in the glove compartment as derivative or fruits of a poisonous tree rather than the direct result of an illegal search?
It's both. It's either, it is at least derivative of the entry into the passenger compartment. That's why I say that the the status of the glove compartment does not matter for the standing determination. In other words, he may have had an expectation of privacy in the glove box as well. Even if he did not, the evidence is gathered through exploitation of the search of the interior of the passenger compartment, which it's undisputed that he had an expectation of privacy.
Yeah. Okay, so that part, that second argument then, would be dependent on us agreeing that that's derivative evidence or fruits rather than the direct result of the search.
Well, I guess what I'm suggesting is that you don't have to decide the status of the glove box to find that he has standing. You cannot dispute that it is not derivative evidence, that it's not direct.
You can't?
Exploitation.
Doesn't it seem like that's the direct result of a search? You're saying the illegal search was the...
Yes, I think you could decide...
You'd like it to separate it into two searches.
No, oh. I think you could decide it on that basis as well.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is Rebecca Adams, and I represent the people of the state of Colorado. I would like to begin by talking about the standing issue in this case, because in the event that this court determines that the defendant does not have standing to challenge the search of the glove box, then the court does not have any need to address the application of Gant or the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. Now, initially, the people are not precluded from arguing that the defendant lacks standing due to the trial court's decision to raise this issue sua sponte in the trial court. Now, while there is no case law directly addressing a trial court's ability to raise an issue sua sponte, this court's decision in Moody addressing a court of appeals' ability to raise standing sua sponte is instructive. The things that concern this court when it was looking at Moody and the court of appeals' ability to raise the standing issue sua sponte talked about the complete and factually developed record that was lacking in that case, and how we're surprising a defendant and not giving him the opportunity to raise issues or to complete the record that he would have had this issue been raised below. Here, however, because this issue was raised in the trial court, we are faced with a fully and factually complete record in this case. And beyond that, because the trial court based its ruling on the defendant's lack of standing, the defendant had the opportunity at that time to either seek reconsideration from the trial court or to request an opportunity to provide a more complete record if he felt that was necessary in order to make a standing argument. But now that we have this issue up on appeal, we do have a complete and factually developed record from which we can make the decision about whether or not the defendant had standing in this case to challenge the search.
Well, he had the car keys by permission, right?
He did have the car keys by permission.
Wasn't that enough?
Well, it would have been enough had the defendant not disavowed his interest in the glove box.
Could you go to that basic argument, assuming that we take the issue up? Not the procedural issue, but, well, it's sort of procedural, sorry, but substantively, the one that Mr. Jekyll makes.
Certainly. Now, while the people agree that as the driver of the automobile, the defendant did have certain privacy interests in the car, he abandoned those interests when he disclaimed any interest in the glove compartment and its content.
That may be true, but it seems like Mr. Jekyll's argument is that, all right, we have a traffic stop, and then the search started where the officer saw inside the glove compartment without opening it, this pouch. And when he did that, he invaded the area that the driver had standing to object. I think that's his argument. And then, you know, we later get into, I don't know what's in there, I don't know how to get in it, you know. So what's wrong with that argument?
Well, I think initially, I'm not sure that the facts are laid out exactly right there. I think that the testimony at the suppression hearing established that the officer was able to view through some crack in the glove compartment, some object inside the glove compartment.
Well, he gave testimony, I thought, that, you know, this is how drugs are, you know, I'm experienced and this is what I see as drugs. So that's a search. And that's a search of the interior compartment. Well, he's using his eyes, he's looking around, right? He's opening the door, he's in there.
Well, I'm not sure exactly if he was looking from standing next to the passenger side or if he could see something from where he was standing next to the automobile. The defendant makes it very clear in his testimony that the officer does not actually enter the car or remove the passenger from the car until the defendant has said, I don't have the combination to that, I don't have access to the glove compartment, and makes these statements. Page 13 of volume 8 of the suppression hearing, the defendant talks about how the officer had come back to the car and told him that he was going to release the car to the passenger.
So in other words, your argument's in plain view?
I'm just saying it's not clear that any search took place prior to the defendant disavowing an interest in the glove box. And anything that the officer could have seen while he was merely talking to the passenger would not be any sort of violation of the defendant's right to privacy at that point. And again, it only really matters if the illegal action of the police were to coerce the defendant into abandoning his property. So if he's going to voluntarily abandon his property and forfeit any expectation of privacy, the actions of the police or any purported illegal actions of the police are only relevant to the extent that they cause the defendant to abandon his property. And in this case, the defendant abandoned his property without any awareness whatsoever regarding what the officer had seen in the glove compartment or if he had attempted to open it or any of those types of things that defense counsel is arguing were illegal in this case.
And is that, I'm not sure I follow that part. I'm with you on the earlier part that it's not clear there's evidence that the police were someplace they weren't allowed to be when they first saw or got a suspicion about this. But with regard to that last argument, does that imply something then about an inevitable discovery? Or, I mean, because even though the defendant hadn't abandoned any interest in the glove box at that point in time, if they first saw the contraband while they were in a position they weren't allowed to be, wouldn't that result in an illegal search, unless they could show that they would inevitably have discovered it anyway?
Well, but if the defendant doesn't have standing to challenge that, And additionally, I don't think that the officer, that the testimony establishes that he was in a position that he wasn't allowed to be at the time that he viewed the contents of the glove compartment.
But you're saying if he doesn't have, if the defendant doesn't have standing to challenge a search of the glove box, then even if he did have, does have standing to challenge a search of the passenger compartment, and the police saw the contraband while conducting an illegal search of the passenger compartment, you're saying that doesn't make any difference?
Well, I'm not sure that, again, that that's what happened in this case.
And appreciate that.
And I don't believe that it's not even clear what was searched first. It appears from the record that the glove box was actually searched prior to the passenger compartment of the car, based on the testimony of the defendant and the officer.
But the defendant is outside the car handcuffed. There's no question about that, right?
There's no question about that.
And he has the keys to the car. He's been driving. He's asserted possession of the car for that purpose, right?
As the authorized user of the car.
Okay, so what under Gantt justifies the police officers to take the next step and begin to search the car in any aspect? To peer in and, you know, look at something that is in there that may or may not have drugs, may have a compass.
Okay, well, there are a couple of things there. First is that the defendant in this case only challenged the search of the glove box. There was no challenge to the search of the passenger compartment of the car. So the search of the passenger compartment of the car is not an issue here. And again, as far as Gantt goes, I think we can all agree that the search of the car incident to the defendant's arrest does not satisfy Gantt. But because the defendant disavowed any interest in the glove box, we don't even have to get to Gantt because he can't even...
So some kind of waiver of his standing argument that he can't assert at a suppression hearing.
He abandoned his standing. Had the defendant simply remained silent or indicated in some way that the evidence in the glove box...
Well, the police are engaging him in conversation, are they not, about what's in the car?
They didn't ask him what was in the car. They asked him if he had a combination to the glove box.
Okay.
And the officers are certainly entitled to look into the locked glove box if they are doing a valid search of the passenger compartment of the car. So they can simply ask him for the combination of the car without asking him...
Well, that begs the question about why they were asking about the glove box, right?
Well, clearly at the time, they thought that they were doing a search incident to the defendant's arrest.
Yes.
I mean, there's no question about that. But the fact that the defendant disavowed any interest in the glove box means that he no longer has standing to object to the search.
Could I follow up just 1 second on that? The more theoretical point here, I guess, that seems to me to be an issue, quite apart from the facts, is it seems to involve a question whether... If a defendant would lack standing with regard to a particular container, let's say a safe or something locked he couldn't get into, belongs to somebody else, but the only way the police could get to that safe is by illegally invading a space that the defendant does have standing with regard to, let's say if it was his house, or in this case, what I take it the defense is arguing is the passenger compartment of the car. Are you saying that he would never have standing to challenge the search of a container he doesn't have standing with regard to, even though that required an illegal entry into a space he does have standing with regard to?
Well, and again, there are more protections provided when you're dealing with a house than a car. But I think it's important here that the defendant not only, I mean, we're focusing on the glove box because that was what the defendant was arguing in the trial court, was that the search of the glove box was illegal. But the defendant really disavowed any interest in the car whatsoever. He said, this is not my car. It belongs to a friend of the passenger. I've only been in it for a short period of time. I don't have anything in the car.
So a possessory interest in the car at that point in time wouldn't give him standing?
It would if he didn't disavow that interest. And I would argue that the defendant's statements not only disavowed his interest in the glove box, which I think is very clear, but also disavowed his interest in the car as well.
It's not very satisfying, is it, when the Supreme Court actually, under the Supremacy Clause, interprets the Fourth Amendment in a way to imply that 30 years of searches have ended up with people in prison who can no longer challenge their conviction because it's final, right? I mean, that's the strange circumstances that we find ourselves in, because we've had this bright-line rule, which is unconstitutional. I mean, that's the plain teaching of Gant, right?
That's the holding of Gant, yes, Your Honor. But again, I guess at this point I can shift and talk with just a little bit about the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule, because the fact remains that this was what we thought was well-established precedent that officers have been relying on for 25 or 30 years at this point. And when we talk about the application of the exclusionary rule, what we look at is whether we have to do a balancing between the deterrence and the cost. And when you look at a situation like this, where officers were relying on what this court on multiple occasions had said was okay, there is no deterrent effect to now excluding the evidence that the officers recovered based on that search. And without a deterrent effect, it's inappropriate to apply the exclusionary rule to the evidence in this case. And again, this is a small class of cases. These are cases that were pending on direct appeal at the time that Gant was announced. And just to briefly address the retroactivity portion, I think that the issue that the Supreme Court took cert in Gant was very narrow and addressed only whether or not this type of search was constitutional under the Fourth Amendment. And there really is no reasoning or analysis in Gant that talks about the good faith exception to the exclusionary rule. And I think that based on the other cases from the Supreme Court, if we look at Leon and Krull and Evans, it seems that when the officers are relying on good faith, that the exclusionary rule doesn't apply. The real question has to be, as the court pointed out in Herring, would a well-trained officer have known that the search was illegal? And here, clearly not, because everything that the officer had at its disposal was telling him that this search was okay. If the court has no further questions, I would ask that this court affirm the trial court's order denying the defendant's motion to suppress.
Thank you. May I just clear up a couple of things about the record as to where the officer is at the time that he is searching the government. And I turn to page 7 of the record. Question, explain that. I stopped the vehicle for a couple of traffic violations, ran him, he had a warrant for his arrest, he also had a suspended license, no insurance, etc. Let's see. Question, after you arrested the defendant, did you search the vehicle? Answer, I did. This is on page 8 to page 9. Did you search the glove box? Answer, I did. Were you able to open the glove box? As to whether or not he would have viewed it in plain view. Answer, I was not able to open it like a normal glove box would open. When I looked inside, I could see an object. Well, where was he when he was looking inside? If you turn to page 16 of the glove box, answer to a question. You couldn't see inside the glove box from the top of it. Answer, I didn't look. I mean, I looked through the side is where I looked through it because that's where I was, knelt down, searching everything else. So that's where I looked. I didn't look around the other side to see if I could see on that side, too. He's in the car. I think that clears up any question as to whether or not the plain view exception applies. I'd ask the court to reverse the Court of Appeals decision in this case.
On behalf of the court, I thank both counsel for your arguments. The case stands submitted. The court will be in recess.